Well, glad you came again. Always glad about that. We have, after tonight, we've got three more lessons till Thanksgiving week. So I promise you'd be done by Thanksgiving, and we will not go back on our word. It doesn't mean we won't have some other lessons after the turn of the year, but what I won't get done this session is Billy Graham, which is neat to deal with Billy Graham, and I think the church growth movement, those two things, they could be separate standing, you know, events without having tie into this series, because I committed I was going to finish the series this year, so I think we can still do that in three more weeks. We have one major discussion to go, that's next week we'll do on the kingdom, which is the mother lode of all of it, because it really drives everything that's out there today. And when I was preparing this lesson, and thought about this before, but it's interesting how the issues that are on the board, I have dispensationalism, we have pre-tribulationalism, and the kingdom, that these issues are, I don't know, the hottest issues there are in theology, and these have to be fought for tooth and nail all the time. And you never can ever let up once for a moment before those positions are eroded. And so why is that? And I don't want to say, well, it's because it's the truth, but I think that's the reason. You know, it'd be an easy thing. Well, just because it's your position, you feel attacked all the time. Well, it is the subject of attack all the time. And it comes from many, many quarters. And some of the most deadly and the most damaging quarters are from within Christianity itself. So we have to kind of hang on by our fingernail sometimes, knowing that the Lord looks after us. He looks after his theology. He looks after his people. He looks after his church. He did say that the gates of hell will not prevail against it, even though they are prevailing against it in a sense. So it just interests me how that these issues are so hot. Last week, we did talk about dispensationalism. My mind doesn't remember things very long either. So what did I say about it? I actually had to go back to my lesson and say, oh, yeah. It was so minor a point last week. It was, remember when, Carnell and Daniel Fuller, Jewett, some of these guys ganged up and decided that they were going to have the dispensational statement taken out of their statement of faith or out of the catalog, and they couldn't get Charles Fuller to agree to it, so they got him to sign an agreement that after he's gone, they would do it. That was it. No discussion about the merits of dispensationalism, the merits of the alternative system. You know, just like, we're not going to have it here. Because if we have it here, we can't do what we want to do with this school, because no one will think us as credible if we have dispensational ideas that are in our school, so we have to take it out. So, you know, so that without any further ado, they just took it out. I mean, there wasn't even a battle. So anyway, it's just interesting to me that these issues are the hot issues, and they still are. You know, I just don't know. I have my thing today. I'm going to tell you that the way that you can find a good church, I don't mean a believing church or anything like that, but ask them two questions. One question is, do you believe in the rapture of the church? And the second question is, when does it happen? That's right. Now, that doesn't mean that the church that answers those questions wrong are not teaching the gospel. But with those two questions, you understand how they read their Bibles, which is foundational to the church. So I have often wondered in our wonderful city here, you'd take that question to the churches of Lincoln that are evangelicals, there are probably around 25 of them, and ask that question, what answer would you get? I don't mean what it says in the statement of faith. I mean, does it get preached from the pulpit? Does it get talked about? You know, I'm sure there are some that it does get talked about, but I would think that those are relatively few and getting to be fewer, because it's seeing too much of a hot issue, and we don't want to deal with things that are controversial because people don't like controversy, and they don't stay in churches where there's controversy, and we have had people leave because that is controversial. But see, that's giving in on the point, and I say that is where you have to stand firm. And Martin Luther's quote that Gil used, and we used that at his 50th anniversary, where says where the enemy engages, that's where you have to stand strong. And the thing you want to preach, at least preach about, that's what you got to preach about. So anyway, we don't want to stand and count noses. We don't want to count people. We don't want to count success, bank accounts. We just want to count faithfulness and let the rest of it to the Lord. And sometimes that's not easy to do. That if you're going to a new town and you're going to find a new church, that's what I'd do. I'd go in there. You guys, you believe in the rapture? You guys teach it over here? You know, just be nonchalant about it. And they say, well, I've never heard of it. What do you mean? Well, let's say, see you next week. So, yeah. It's just a way to get to the chase rather than say, well, how big is your budget or how many people you have on staff? You know, how many missionaries you send out? You know, ask the question, what's the basis of the theology of the church? You'll know if you answer that question, well, we believe in the rapture of the church. Well, then they're reading the Bible like we do or like God wanted us to read it. So anyway, these, pardon? Pardon? You may not what? Well, you know what I would do. I'd stay at home and start building my own. Come on down. I don't know, at 82, I probably wouldn't do that either. So it's difficult. People do go to different churches in the different cities and want to know what's a good church. And it's probably too strict a standard, but I'm giving up a standard if I don't ask that question. And the person says, well, I don't really know what you mean. Or, yeah, I'm sure we do. Well, yeah, I think so. Like the guy one time said here, came from a church and said, well, I'm sure they preach the gospel there, but I've only been there a year. So, you know, you want to have it, you know, I don't know when is the last time Gil preached on the rapture and say, well, maybe, you know, that's the standard, maybe too tight, but you get the spirit of what I'm asking. If the church teaches that or they're aware of it and they hold it, and they don't have mind teachers teaching it in the classes, those kind of things, then, or encouraging them to, not mind, encourage them to, then maybe some help. So, all right. Well, what else I have on the board? Oh, my little drawing over here. I had to make sure that you understood that that is a wrong diagram. This is a wrong diagram. All right, so that's what I put down here, wrong scheme. Because some people walk in and says, oh, I see you got a new diagram for the tribulation in your church. I didn't know you guys believed that, you know. So that makes sure it's a wrong one. So. All right, we're going to go. When Charles E. Fuller decided that he wanted to establish a school that would carry on the ministry of the word in evangelism into the next generation, there's no doubt that he would have wanted it to continue on the same basis that had carried him into the unparalleled effectiveness across the nation and even around the world. The basis for his success was the clear presentation of the joyful noise, Jesus saves. It is understandable that in his desire to form a school that he would enlist another effective minister of the gospel to achieve this goal. He can't do it himself. The choice of Harold Ockengay looked to be a good one, a well-connected evangelical pastor from Boston who had his hands in other ministries, served on other boards. He could be the right choice for putting the dream into reality. Well, the next influential person was Carl F. H. Henry. Ockengay recruited Henry to be the first professor of theology, and he served there until 1955, so about 8 years. Then he went on to be the editor of Christianity Today until 1968, and he quit because the fundamentalists were criticizing the paper too much. I don't know if you remember that, but the Christianity Today was never a very popular magazine amongst the fundamentalists. It was too far away from, you know, what they felt comfortable with. So they did criticize it. And I remember in those days, I wasn't as aware as I am now. And I read the Christianity Today, and I wasn't, you know, cutting theology very carefully. And, you know, it didn't really influence me one way or the other. But I just know there was a lot of criticism about the paper. Well, Henry had written the Uneasy Conscience book in about 1946 as a doctoral program at Harvard and brought with him the conviction that the evangelicals were erring in their approach to saving Christianity in America particularly. Well, it became the settled conviction of the Fuller faculty that some changes in fundamentalism needed to be made. Now, it didn't start there. It started earlier with a new evangelical group called the National Association of Evangelicals, which Akinkaye was a founding partner in. So this sort of got to be a understood motivation or direction of the school, of the faculty. And the areas that were targeted for Reformation, I'm not sure they wrote these down on a piece of paper, but this is what it ends up being looked like. That is to tone down the shrill voice of the fundamentalist who spoke against all errors and recover the social sensitivity to the needy in the culture, and to step up the level and volume of scholarly work to carry the message of the evangelicals far and wide, especially to the liberals who were not listening to them anymore because the fundamentalists were shouting them out. Well, the first attempt to be inclusive did not work very well. Vasily, a neo-Orthodox professor from Hungary, felt his way out the door since his views of inerrancy killed any further consideration, much to their disappointment, because he was supposed to be the bridge. His invitation to join the American fundamentalism was meant to heal the wounds of the embrace of fundamentalist action of Charles Fuller himself when he left the Presbyterians and started, what is it, Calvary Church of Santa Ana. But the Presbyterians were not easily consoled, refused to accept Vasily and the extended apology. Well, that didn't go so well. The next hires were at the polar ends of a conservative theological stick. Charles Woodbridge on the right and George Elton Ladd on the left. In the end, outspoken Woodbridge would not offset the damage done by the likes of the Ladd. They don't offset each other. Until Ladd, the school was not vocal about dispensationalism. Kind of like, you never talk about it. I said before, well, we believe it, but we don't teach it. Well, when something is assumed, then it's soon to be denied. You know, and you quit talking about it, you soon deny it. That's what happened. With the addition of Ladd, during the next 6 years, he honed the skills of his pen and speech to destroy dispensationalism lovingly, and as we will see, pre-tribulationalism. Although he did it carefully, believing that widely held dispensationalism destroyed any hope of getting acceptance from liberal scholars. So I think that's probably what drove him. I don't know what drove him, but I know that he thought that if there were going to be a dispensation school, no one would ever read their work. And we would say, why do we care? But they did, because remember, they felt that the fundamentals had split off from the modernists, and that was wrong. The idea of church unity goes back here a little bit. So how can you be a witness to the world if you're not in unity? Well, we find out that the unity is not in the group. The unity is in obedience. That's where the unity lies. Well, all of this was done, this dispensational, pre-tribulational destruction is done under the watchful eyes of the academic freedom. Akinkaye, a mild dispensationalist, were not threatened by Ladd's investigatory papers on post-tribulationalism. After all, they were an academic institution where anything goes. Now, I put this up here just in case somebody doesn't know what we're talking about. The bottom one is. The top one is the post. Let me get my arrow going here. The top one is the post-tribulational return of the Lord. So when I say post-tribulational, it means this is the tribulation mark through here, all right? So it's post-tribulation. Whoops, do it the other way. So the Lord returns at the end of the tribulation. Now, I got a little bit of a problem how to explain this because people that don't believe in tribulation talk about a post-tribulation return of the Lord. Does that make any sense to you? Like, all millennials don't believe in the millennial kingdom. So they deny whatever. So they don't usually use the word post, Roger. They usually don't use the word post-tribulational. They use historic premillennialism today. But it's post-tribulationalism. So, all right. So all they do is move the rapture from before the tribulation and move it to after the tribulation. Let's move, mark this out here. So before the trib, after the trib. Now one more caveat here. Some people think that this whole thing here is the tribulation, And some think this is the tribulation. You can't see that. Just this is the tribulation. Now, Lad, our guy, is going to go with just the 7 years, although he never actually explicitly says it, but it seems like that's what he assumes. But there's some problems with that. So down road, downstream, you can see they abandoned that idea and said, oh, well, that's right, the tribulation goes through an entire church period. So we're in the tribulation today. So, okay. The rest of it's pretty much alike, because they believe in a Gentile, or sorry, they believe in a kingdom. In this case, it's going to be a Gentile-dominated kingdom. In pre-mill, pre-trib, it's a Jewish-dominated kingdom. And the church does not go into the tribulation. It is raptured out of the tribulation. And it is in heaven at the Bema Seat, judged during this period, and returns to the earth with the Lord at the second advent to enjoy the millennial kingdom as it's been promised everyone that's a believer. Is there any question about that? Well, you get at the sore point right away. Because, as I show on the board here, the rapture and the coming of the Lord in the air necessitates they turn right around and come back to the earth. Yeah. So they do not allow a space in here. They have not answered that question yet, because we'll do this in our class, but I'll do it for you now. If the believers are taken in a rapture and the unbelievers are taken in judgment, which everybody agrees to, they don't get to go to the millennium. Who is there left to populate the millennium or the kingdom? They don't have an answer for that. So this is one of those things that really is interesting to me. When you get somebody into a spot like this, you'd usually think if we were talking about acorns and corn cobs, that you'd just change the view. You'd rearrange things to make it work. No, they're hanging on to it so hard that they do not want to go back to the real answer. And this is my statement I opened up with: why in the world is pre-tribulational, pre-millennial dispensational views so disdained? But you got it. There is a problem with that. We will deal with that. Anything else? So that was up just to make sure we all understood that the difference really is where the rapture occurs, and of course with it comes baggage, like you just suggested. So we have these issues, and we're going to spend time on that. We had that last week. Okay, we have a weakening theology going on. Well, Fuller was still developing its own character in those early years, especially in relation to the issues facing the evangelical movement at large. Actually, the nature of the Bible, what is it exactly, and is it really inerrant? Does it teach ecumenicalism? In other words, is there really one body, and we embrace everybody that claims to be Christian, and they're in the circle of friendship and ministry together? The practice of ecclesiological separation, as church separation, I mean, how much, you know, do we participate? How much is my life separate from my neighbor who's a declared unbeliever, and I'm, you know, saying I'm a believer and follow Christ, and the morals that go with that? And other issue is also doctrinal things, you know, when is this kind of person and this person believes this? And I mean, is there anywhere that you draw a line, or we all just kind of accept each other and never talk about our theology? So these things are really kind of up in the air in these early years of Fuller. And we'll do this next week. Ladd recast the kingdom of God into something that's present rather than in the future. So that necessitates, first of all, we got to destroy dispensationalism and pre-tribulationalism, which really are together. You cannot have dispensationalism without having pre-tribulationalism. They are together. In fact, if you're a pre-tribulationalist, you are a dispensationalist. If you believe the Lord's going to come in the rapture, you are a dispensationalist. That's why I said that question before. So let's talk about Ladd. One of the earliest hires at Fuller was coming from Gordon College, it's called now, I guess. Originally a missionary training school, conservative, in then a Bible college, eventually a liberal arts school up in New England. I think it's in Boston. I'm not sure. He applied for funding for writing a project lad wanted to research and write about the kingdom of God in Jewish and early Christian thought, but his project was not accepted. I'm really disappointed in that. I think that might have helped him. Well, we'll see. Akagi on the board of Gordon is likely the reason Ladd moved to California. Many of those guys, three of them at least, came from Gordon, came to Fuller. He was one of them. Akagi on the board of Gordon is likely the reason Ladd moved to California with the hope of having time to write, plus a 46% increase in the salary to a grand total of $6,000 a year. Now, you know, that's not even below, I don't know, it didn't pay your rent, does it? You know, we had that inflationary spiral up in the 70s, but I graduated in college in 1962, and if you made $100 a week, you were doing really well. So it's $5,200 a year. So this would have been a little bit before that, so the money would have been pretty good for him. I always thought when I graduated that a doctor, you know, was probably making 10, and an engineer would make about 5. So that's kind of so what are you making today? Take that times 10, and you got about the right figure of comparables. So anyways, a lot of money that he improved himself on. Well, we can only hope that if Ladd would have received the funds to do the research of the Jewish research on the Jewish thought of the kingdom of God, which would have put him on the right track, that he would have discovered the anti-Semitism in the early church fathers. That might have helped him. But would he agree with them if we had done this paper? Would he agree with them and justify the revision in God's program that we now have? Or would he recognize that the fathers were really juveniles and in a totally flawed Christianity for most of its adherents, which is the truth? But the history is that he came to California instead. We only suppose where Ladd picked up his anti-Jewish ideas, which is underneath this, I do believe, aimed at dispensationalists. But we know that in 6 years, by 1956, his machete on pre-mill and pre-trib was well-honed and was swinging, but he did it kindly. His obsessive quest for a place in a respectable doctoral program exposed some of the psychological wounds of inferiority and inadequacy. And I'm going to quote here from a book called The Place at the Table by D'Elsa. He wrote a favorable biography of Ladd. It's an expose, but he was favorable. And so he names his book A Place at the Table because this is exactly what Elton Ladd wanted all his life. He just wanted to sit at the big table with the other guys. And now we have some psychological analysis of him, which I'm not going to vouch for, but this is what they said about him, D'Ella said about him. His obsessive quest for a place in a respectable doctoral program exposed some of his psychological wounds of inferiority and inadequacy that he developed as a result of his family's poverty and search for a school. In both his pastoral and academic work, however, he found acceptance at Harvard, which soothed some of his negative self-perception, and completing the program with distinction still more. But the wounds were deep and persistent, and as Ladd moved into his life as a professional scholar, we see his emotional brittleness that is a direct result of those early events. Ladd struggled with his sense of inferiority for the rest of his life. Looking back, he remembered parents who could not hear him. I think they were deaf. I was going to look that up, but I think they were deaf parents, could not hear. I'm assuming that's true here, what's meant here. He remembered parents who could not hear him, and a brother he deeply resented and envied. And as a consequence, he saw himself as a perpetual outsider longing for acceptance. In opposition to these negative family legacies, the twin academic influences of Gordon and Harvard provided important counterbalances to the psychological turmoil in his life. I never excuse anybody for any of this stuff, but that's what it said about him. Harvard provided a baptism by immersion in the highest level of academic work, while Gordon's ironic spirit helped Ladd navigate the doctoral battles to come. By 1950, he was ready for the chance to focus more of his time and energy on research and writing and to make his mark in the world of theological scholarship. The move to Fuller Seminary would provide that opportunity. Well, I say, you know, Ed is me. In the first 5 years of Fuller, Ladd develops a strategy that will rehabilitate supposedly the fundamentalist. But what exactly was Ladd trying to rehabilitate? They were doing so well. It was the literalism of the fundamentalists, their dispensationalism that kept them separate and out of the mainstream of scholars. That's what he wanted to rehabilitate. So Ladd, going back to the book, so Ladd chose to offer a detailed critique of dispensationalism, the dominant theology system within conservative evangelicalism, which I've told you 100 times. It was dispensationalism from 1925 on, and it was pretty much wall to wall, you know, floor to floor. That's the way everybody taught, except for rare exceptions. So Ladd chose to offer a detailed critique of dispensationalism, a dominant theological system within conservative evangelicalism, from an almost equally conservative point of view. So he's supposedly not giving up his conservativeness to do this. As part of this strategy, he initiated a dialogue with John Walvoord, Dallas Seminary president, a leader at the academic home of dispensational theology, and this interaction set the tone for Ladd's relationship to the conservative wing of his own movement. Again, me, Ladd wrote a number of books. Some were directed at reforming the fundamentalists, that is to pry them away from dispensationalism. Some were written to impact the modernists, drift away from the truth of the resurrection, for example. So we will look in our studies at two books, one tonight, which were aimed at correcting fundamentalism, which is first to destroy dispensationalism, and then the second book is to destroy the Jewish idea of a kingdom, which dispensational theology supports. Well, from within they will introduce preverse things. Wrong, they need a P in there. Reverse thing, that's okay too. Whatever it was that turned Ladd, a Northern Baptist, turned to be conservative Baptist, away from dispensationalism or premillennialism may never be known. Why he was so dangerous and effective is that his small deviation produced historic premillennialism, and with it a large defection was escalated into full-blown postmodernism, where there are no absolutes. This is where it's going, folks. While Ladd pled with Walvoord at Dallas to include his post-trib view as acceptable, the end of Fuller is the reason Walvoord wisely did not accept him. The deviant always wants to be countered in as normal. Think about that. I'm going to be a little different, but I don't want to be outside. I want you to include me, right? I want to be included in this, you know, because if I'm outside of this room, then no one's going to recognize me as, you know, part of you. So I want to be included in it. So his appeal is to be included, but he doesn't want to change his view. He just wants to be different within the group, and you're different in the group, you could destroy the group. Walvoord understood that, and so he didn't play games with that. And we'll see Walvoord in a minute here. The rapture is the departing of the church saints from the earth, at which time those who so removed will get their glorified eternal body. That's what we look for. This is the first resurrection, a quality, a translation of the saints who have died or are alive since Acts chapter 2. We call them the church. There's another first resurrection, and they're in time, but it's in quality, of all believers who predate the church and die after the rapture, but in the tribulation, predate the church. That's Old Testament. This resurrection is at the Christ's second coming to earth, where Old Testament saints are resurrected, will enjoy kingdom blessings. I think I've got that here for you. So this is the same chart we've had before. And we have two resurrections, but they're really one resurrection. They're two different times, but the same resurrection. They are the saints at the church, and they're the saints that come out of the Old Testament. In other words, Abraham would be resurrected here after the tribulation. But before the tribulation, the church, those that are alive will be caught up together with him, and those that are dead in Christ are raised at that time. So we have two different times when resurrections occur for the righteous, only two. And we have only one time where they are resurrected to judgment, and that's the end of the millennial kingdom down here at the end, which I have marked this way. All right, so read it on the top. The first resurrection is a resurrection of the righteous in all ages, even though there are two times that it happens. The second resurrection is a resurrection of the unrighteous of all ages at the great white throne, judgment, These are thrown into the lake of fire. Okay. Now we must look at Ladd because it is due to his influence that many dispensationalists gave up the hope of deliverance from the wrath to come for the truth that the church has the dubious prospect of enduring the tribulation and martyrdom with the Jews. Now that is the blessed hope. Tongue in cheek to me. Normally, adjustments are made to one's theology when there is some problem, and new insight fixes the problem. Well, here we have the opposite. The new solution creates a basket of problems that were smoothly answered in the literal truth. So why does he do this? Well, he didn't understand it. That's why. That gave him the best. Well, there are all these supposed problems with pre-trib, and I just put down one guy's idea of what the problems are. I said, well, they're not too bad. For one thing, he says it's a new doctrine. Well, that makes it bad. I mean, if it was true, does it make it bad? The question is biblical? Well, he says it's a new doctrine, but it necessarily isn't because these ideas, he said, they say, these ideas of rapture go well before 1830 with Darby. And I suggest William Watson's book, his Denver Seminary guy, wrote about the appearance of the rapture, the tribulation in literature in England, in the library there, the museum, the British Museum. They weren't as clean and neatly put together as Darby put it, perhaps, but the ideas were already there. They weren't organized. The idea of immacy was in the early church. Whenever you have the idea of an anytime return of the Lord, you are implying a rapture, although not clearly developed. Everybody admits to that. Well, so supposedly that's the problem. It's a new doctrine. Well, it's really not a new doctrine. The return of Christ is in two phases. Well, I say not really, because he only comes to earth once. He comes in the air, doesn't touch the ground, probably on purpose, and gathers his bride, goes back to heaven, spends his time judging them, and brings them back to earth the second advent. So you want to call those two phases? I don't know. There's a guy at pre-trib conference 2 years ago presented a paper where he presented these rapture and the second coming as one phase. You know, you say if you look at it from 1,000 years and they're 7 years apart, it almost looks like it's the same thing. You know, he came in the air and he comes to earth. I mean, you can almost argue that what is one coming to earth, and this is what it was. So the return of Christ in two phases, they don't like that. Why this is a problem is because amillennialists pre-ideas. They just don't like this whole idea of Christ would come in two phases. That just doesn't sit well with them. I don't know why, but it doesn't. In dispensation, there is only one return to earth. The other is in the air, purposely avoiding the return to earth so that we don't have two returns to the earth. Number three, believers are saints in the tribulation, of course, but they're not the church. So some people read saints in the tribulation. They say, saints are the church, so therefore the church is in the tribulation. Well, there are a lot of saints in the Old Testament that aren't in the church. So these are problems for the people that would say that we have a problem. So I don't see a problem. Not at all. Number four, we have two resurrections, two times when the first resurrection occurs of the saints who have died. And as I said, the first is a quality of resurrection for the kingdom. So there can't be anything wrong with that. I mean, so you have them come alive one time for the church, one time for the Old Testament. The same kind of resurrection. They go to the same place. And then no timeline is laid out for the pre-tribs. Well, I'd say there's no time laid out for the post-tribs either. So I don't know why that's an argument yet. I think there is a timeline. Daniel 9:24-27, I said 100 times, if you don't have Daniel 9:24-27 in your mind, you don't have an idea what's going to happen, because that is the timeline. And then Matthew 24 expands on that timeline, and it gives a clear corresponding one. The post-tribs just do not want to acknowledge Israel's major role in the tribulation. That's the problem. So does that go back to anti-Semitism? Who knows? Well, the question about the timing of the rapture was not a new subject in the 1950s. And it's probably just the tip of an iceberg. So let's recap a little bit. The timing of the rapture did not have uniform support at the Bible conferences from 1875 on. Not uniform. I say it was, pre-trib was dominant, but there were some outliers. And I believe it was through the growing influence of post-tribulationalism that the conferences were disbanded in 1900s. So I'm not saying that it wasn't an influence. They were there. Well, now we have two options. So what's the option for us? Despair, or whenever we're confronted with two options, well, the first reaction is usually throw up your hands in the air and give up or blame God for not being more clear about these events. Neither one of them are right answers. As I said before, holding any truth is never an easy task. Just notice the drift in the seminaries, the schools, the mission agencies, in people, in children and grandchildren. The drift is natural, slowly, sometimes imperceptible until it's too late. That is just always the way it is. And the steadfastness talked about in the Bible requires attention to details, and efforts must be made to refute those who contradict Jude. It takes work. I don't want to do it. You have to do it. Once truth is lost, it will take an earthquake of theology, in theology, in a new generation to recover it, and then it'll just drift again. I remember when I had the videos up here 3-4 weeks ago with the Suffrage Conference, and it was Philip Johnson that said, why is it, he asked this question rhetorically, why is it that the drift is so slow away from the truth? And if there ever is a correction to it, it has to be a seismic correction. In other words, it goes like from here to this, like the Reformation. It jumped back. You know, we call it awakening. There is this jump back. A whole new generation has to be formed because this generation can't be saved. So God starts over again. So this is the pattern always in church history. So once truth is lost, it slides imperceptibly. I'm tired. I'm going to go sleep. I don't want to deal with it. I want to be in church where there's controversy. I want to go someplace where it's peaceful. I'm drifting. Kids notice that. The kids start picking up on this. It's not so important if dad said it was. It's not important to my dad. My mom's not important to me either. So the slide goes on and on and on. Okay, so holy truth is never an easy task. One of the criticisms and attack on dispensationalism is that pre-trib issue was a test of orthodoxy. That's Ladd. Why should pre-trib be a test of orthodoxy? Well, because if you don't test there, where will you test it? So Ladd and so forth did not accept this because he wanted to be included in orthodoxy, yet hold the other views. I have used this as a test in finding a good church. I asked two questions, and you to know if you find what kind of church it is. Do you believe in the rapture? And when do you believe it occurred? Those two will define the church, the theology. Not meant to see if the church preaches the gospel, because they probably could and will, I don't know. But it will reveal how they read their Bibles, which is the foundation of the truth. The literal reading brings you to the premillennial, pre-tribulational rapture and the return of the Lord. If the hermeneutic is wrong, the interpretation or reading is wrong, the rest eventually be compromised, just as it was at Fuller Seminary. By the way, they are a model of how not to do this. Another thing to remember regarding the fundamentalist militancy, the fundamentalists used largely defensive measures. They react. Fuller could not have Vassity as a professor without the fundamentalists objecting in defense of orthodoxy. They never had a chance to vote on it and say to do it or not. You know, it wasn't in their purview. So Fuller had acted, which was the offense, not offensive, but offense. Fuller had acted, took the offense. The fundamentalists only had the defense action left. But to the outsider, this may seem to be an over-the-top reaction. But they had no other choice except to give in, which they didn't want to do. So whenever, it's kind of like football. You know, the first guy that throws the punch gets away with it. It's the reaction guy that gets it all the time. It's that kind of thing. Well, you didn't notice the first punch was thrown here. That was what's wrong. Oh, well, that was okay. That's within. But the other guy reacts. Oh, he can't react like that. Well, if you don't react like that, the guy that threw the first punch gets his way. Same way with this. That's why I have decided that the prince of the air has always the upper room in any battle on earth. He's got the first punch, and we have to always react. And when we react, it always looks so bad. But he's throwing the first punch, and we can't turn this around. We can't throw the first punch. We can't do it. All we can do is share the gospel, and then God throws the punch. But Irenic, Ladd, undertakes the offensive posture, looking for folks who are he goes out and writes these letters, looking for folks who are post-tribulationists to join him in his attack on the established position. This is in the book, the place around 65 of the book, it is, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 pages, goes to a list of people that he contacted. And by the way, this D'Elsa wrote his book with all the fuller archives open for him to read and study. So, I mean, he's reading some really interesting stuff, firsthand stuff, like a good historian would. So he goes out looking for these. That's how I know this, because he found these things. So Ladd goes out and looks for these guys that are post-trib. And they're out there, but they're not talking, you know. In his book, he makes the claim that the question is going to be settled on a biblical issue, he says. But he sought the support of others. Do we suppose that a majority could overrule the pre-tribulationalism? You know, in his book, he starts out, I'm going to make my case on the Bible. And then he goes on to talk about the church fathers. I said, which is it now? We're going to build it on church fathers or on the Bible? Well, he tries to do both. But anyway, that's what he's doing. He's trying to find support for his view. While there were some pre-tribs, none or very few joined him in this endeavor. Because it would have been costly for them to come out against pre-tribulation, because that was the prevailing theology in most of the schools, even towards the 1950s, they start putting it in their statements of faith because they could see the drift coming, and they started to close the door and wrote these claims in the statement of faith, so if you're going to be on the staff here, you've got to sign off on these. So this was the theology, okay? So there were some post-tribs. None or very few of them joined his endeavor. It would have been costly for them to come out against pre-tribulationalism. It was not expressed perfectly, but the system had biblical support. Pre-tribs, pre-mill, was the normally accepted fundamentalist position. And to go against that would put you outside of a job, perhaps. The fear of being exposed as having views outside the bounds of dispensational orthodox was very palatable, according to this writer, even equivalent to those times of being branded a communist. Well, that's pretty good. So I asked the question again, where do you hold the line? If it's not going to hold it here, the next point's going to be harder. So the fundamentalists knew that. We'll get to Walvoord, I hope today, my goodness, 50 minutes left. We get to Walvoord, and he says, we're going to hold the line right here. And then Ladd will come back and say, that's too harsh. But who was right? Walvoord was right. Where did Fuller go? Now, Fuller Seminary, Dallas Seminary, followed, but it took another 20 or 30 years. But at least for the time being, they did the right thing. Of course, Walvoord is gone, so other people start running the school not so insistent. Okay, so no one wanted to repeat the trauma of Western Seminary, where people were outed, so to speak, of their non-dispensational viewpoint, and they were, I don't know, lost their job or risked losing their job, but they didn't want anybody to be out and expose what they really believed, so they kept it quiet. So this is not so bad, because it's a normal, common thing. We are loyal to the institution we serve, and we wish there'd be more loyalty, like in our government. You know, now anybody in the government can say anything they want to and destroy the leader of the government, and everybody's saying, well, it's not wonderful. No, it's not wonderful. You don't have to be part of the government, then don't join whatever the philosophy of it is. So we have with businesses or soldier groups, or churches, or schools. If you don't agree with the church or the school or social group, get a different school, different social group, whatever. But be loyal to the group that you're in. That's all it is. It needs to be loyal. Well, it was clear to Ladd as he went to work on his next book, The Blessed Hope, that he would have to act largely alone in this effort. No one joined him. As a credit to the leaders of the fundamentalists, they did not give in to any of the devices proposed by post-tribulationalism. You know, these guys were post-trib, but they weren't going to come out and kind of be disloyal. This post-tribulation was a long-disputed event, as I said, even from the 1900s. So the fundamentalists, when they saw the duck coming, they immediately recognized it. But this awareness will soon disappear with the Fuller's generation, when historic premillennialism robs many churches and schools of the actual blessed hope. I put this in here just in case I needed it. I don't think I need it. We'll go on. Well, what does the literal reading of the Bible produce? Well, we have Exhibit A, Robert Gunnery, a post-tribulational writer. In fact, when his book came out in the 70s, I know Larry Rickenberg read it first, and these are the days when we were having some difficulty with one of our graduates that came from Grace College of the Bible, who had a 4.0 average, first student that ever graduated with a 4.0 average, which is remarkable. And we found out that he was post-trib. We were going to hire him for a particular job, whatever. Get into that. We can't do that. Well, I found out that this Gundry book was a great influence on him. So Larry Rickenberg read it first, and here I am. My teeth are shaking. I'm going to read this book, and I'm going to have to change my view because the arguments are so great and so overwhelming. I just will have to do nothing but become a post-tribulational, give up dispensationalism, everything. Fearful. So I read the book and said, what is it? There's nothing in here. Said, that's the book. So this is kind of dear to my heart. I remember this book. He says in the first page, first chapter, about us, about reading the Bible literally. He says, in the chronological question, this is his quote, in the chronological question concerning the rapture, the dispensational issue centers in the field of ecclesiology, which is the church, that an absolute silence in the Old Testament about the present age, the church age, one, a total disconnection of the church from the divine program for Israel, number two, and a clean break between dispensations. I imagine he's saying Old Testament and New Testament, which I would say I'd break at Acts, not at Matthew. Clean break between those. The church would not likely be related to the seventh week of Daniel, which is the Jewish week, we say, or the tribulation, a period of time clearly having to do with Israel. This is what he's describing. If you read the Bible literally, this is what you're going to get. He's post-trib saying this. Now, but a partial revelation of the present age in the Old Testament, part of the church is in the Old Testament, a connection, but not necessary identification between Israel and the church, a soft identification between the two, and a dispensational change involving transitional periods between the two systems, open the door to the presence of the church during the tribulation. So he contrasted the two systems. In pre-tribulationalism, the dealings of God with the church are severed from his dealings with Israel. Okay, he's back to the dispensational view. Justification for the severance derives from the designation as mysteries of certain churchly doctrines missing in the Old Testament. There's nothing said in the Old Testament about the church. He's right. He's representing us exactly right. These mysteries sharply set apart the church. Now, here's this guy says, if you read the Bible, literally, that's what you're going to get. But I don't buy it. What are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to do? He writes a whole book now saying it's wrong. That's why you need scholars. Okay, so I just wanted you to hear from a post-tribulationist who can see what we see in the text, didn't have to make it up, is exactly what we would say as dispensationalists. The division of the church in Israel, the distinction, nothing revealed about the church in the Old Testament. There's definitely a break between the Old and New Testament. We're not under the law, we're under the grace, whatever kind of stuff, however you want to explain that. So I call Mr. Gundry doubly guilty when a post-tribulationist can differentiate between the post and the pre's, as Gundry has. What hatred does he harbor for the Jews that he would cut them off? That's what he's doing. The Jews don't fit here. With this insight, there must be a double blindness. Some do not believe because they cannot see. Here, Gundry does not believe, even though he can see. And I say, just remarkable. Well, this is really an interesting thought to me. Now, this is me. In my study on this issue, I'm talking particularly about my study at this time, because I have to think back on whether this be true for all my studies. I don't think it would be for all my studies, but for this preparation, in my study of this issue, which would be read the historical stuff, you know, whatever. I don't read books and books and books. I don't have time for it. But in my study of this issue, I have yet to come across anyone who has made the case for dispensationalism based on the Abrahamic covenant, developed as the land, seed, and the king and kingdom, and the new covenant, which is the blessing covenant. I've not seen anybody start there. In fact, it's rare for anybody even to refer to it. And I say, this is the starting place. This is where I got to start when I understand what's right. These contracts must be fulfilled before anything else can be asserted. Now, I don't know if this is going to work for you or not, but we have farms. And we always forward contract our grain. Always, usually. Which means you sell so many bushels and you deliver it at a certain time to the elevator for a certain price, all right? But there's always other grain that we raise that's not in the contract. Now, if you're going to deal with the elevator honestly, what is the first thing you're going to do? The first grain you bring is going to be to fulfill the requirements of the contract. When that's done, then you talk about what's left. Okay? That's the principle that we should use here in the scriptures. The contract has to be filled with Abraham. The land, seed, and blessing has to be fulfilled. And then we can talk about what else did God do. And that is not the way it's been handled in my studies. And I said, man, it would be so much easier if we start with the Abrahamic covenant. Because we'd have the land there, we'd have the David there, the king there, we'd have the kingdom there, because David expected a kingdom on earth, and it'd be an eternal king, son of him in the dynasty of David, fits the messianic promise, and we have the blessing of the new birth, because they needed a new birth, because it's not going to happen without God intervening in these sinful people's lives to save them. So it's all there, and we got that done. So Israel's in the land, they got their king, they got their kingdom. Now, well, let's talk about the church. That's the order. But you don't mess with Israel when you start talking about the church. See, that's what happens if you do this, I call it a biblical way. Do it the way the Bible lays it out. So the Jewish promises must be accounted for in eschatology before we can even begin to talk about the church as a mystery truth. And that is not how I have read anybody approach it that way. And it would solve it, because everybody wants to jump in. Well, let's start at Matthew 23 or Matthew 24, where you're going to be lost, because you need to have some track to run on. You have no track to run on. And I say, well, if you don't do that, start with Daniel 9:24 at least. Well, don't do that either. It may come up. So I'm frustrated with this, because everybody's going going about this in a wrong way. Okay, well, I'm looking at my clock. I'm half done. Well, what I have here is John Wolford takes Ladd's book, it came out in 56, and he does a book review. Now, Ladd had already published in Biblis Thekasacra, whatever that place is called, that put, you know, Deal refers to it sometimes. The publishing, Dallas Seminary got the rights to it, and they used it to publish their papers in. Well, Ladd had already, as a scholar from Fuller, in those days everything was kind of kumbaya yet, published some of his articles in this Bibliotheca. Well, when Ladd writes the book, John Wolford does a review of it. And that's what I wanted to share with you, because I was going to do this myself. I said, no, Don, don't be so silly. Let somebody else do the work. Somebody that's a whole lot better at it than you are. So there are about 40 panels for me to get through this. I don't want to start this. So we'll have to do it next week.